The first reading this morning is taken from psychotherapist Tom Rutledge's 2002 book with the very intriguing title, Embracing Fear.
A common fear and criticism of psychology is that self-forgiveness is a snazzy, socially acceptable way of letting ourselves off the hook by avoiding accountability and personal responsibility. This is absolutely not true. Self-forgiveness is the natural starting place for anyone who wants to lead an ethical life as free from hypocrisy as is humanly possible. Think of it this way. When I was a kid, my father owned a dry cleaning store. As an adolescent, I drove his delivery truck, picking up and delivering dry cleaning all around the small town where I grew up. I was working to meet the needs of my dad's customers. Was my father selfish for taking excellent care of that truck? Was he being selfish to make sure that that truck tank was full, that the oil was changed on schedule, and that the tires were aligned? Of course not. My dad's priority care of that truck was not about being selfish. It was about being smart. Without regular quality maintenance, the delivery truck would eventually require much more time and attention, not to mention money, than he could afford. People are the same way. Self-forgiveness is that regular maintenance that keeps us on the road. The self-forgiving person is not, as many believe, or at least fear, a selfish person. It is the person who remains stuck in self-doubt and self-condemnation who will lead the more selfish, less productive life. Self-forgiveness keeps us from being stuck. It keeps us moving.
And the second reading comes from Joan Borisenko's book, Minding the Body, Mending the Mind, a book now 22 years old.
You can be clear about whether or not a person's behavior is acceptable without judging the person. You are stupid is a very different statement from your behavior is not acceptable to me. If a person knows you respect him or her, your comments about behavior are welcome. If you are attacking a person's character, however, no comment, no matter how perceptive, will be heeded. Forgiveness starts with ourselves and extends to others. Accepting that the core of your being is as precious and wonderful as that of any other person is the greatest gift you can ever give yourself.
Im shana tavo halenu, im shana. Im shana shilo halenu, im shana. Matana nilech halenu, matana. Yamim shila hava beyacha inshala. Od yavoy hayom shalom vesalam yikodu. Peyadim yisrom nigana shalom alenu. Od yavoy hayom shalom vesalam yikodu. Od yavoy hayom. Im shana tavo alenu, im shana. Im shana shilor alenu, im shana. Matana hilech alenu, matana. Yamim shila hava beyacha nishala.
You always have to start where you are, my preaching professor Ron Cook used to say. You can't deliver a very convincing sermon on the power of love if your heart was broken the day before. And you can't offer many helpful words on the wonders of compassion if you're still nursing a deep grudge. So start where you are, always. But then, he added with a twinkle, get to where you very much need to go. So on this Sunday, when we celebrate the wisdom found in the most important holiday in our Jewish taproot tradition, to wit, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the Day of At-One-ment, I have to begin where I am, and I am grieving, as you heard. My colleague and good friend, Forrest Church, died this week at 6 p.m. on Thursday. Because of the amazing speed of the modern electronic network, Jo Linda, our religious education director, bless her heart, got the news and called me at home by 8 o'clock in the evening, just 2 hours after Forrest died. I wept a good while, as is my personal grieving practice, and then I sat down and I started to write, which is also a personal grieving practice. Here is what I wrote. On hearing of the death of Forrest Church, Thursday night, the 24th of September, 2009. On and on they went, singing Rest Eternal, pens Pasternak at the beginning of Zhivago. I've always loved that simple line of dark peasants gathered around a grave in autumn, the ancient, steady and rhythmic emblem of love and death. Maybe Forrest might rest now too, but even so, I can't imagine that the stars will stop their singing or close their eyes, or that the laughter of maple leaves giggling in the park will flutter asleep anytime soon. I can't see any memorial causing the relentless force of the love he gave away to swerve off path or make tepid his simmering sense of the just and the holy. I can't believe his skipping, playful words will refuse to finally sink into the soul's shimmering depths, or that his tomes will close because his lips have. Forests rest, I sing with the other peasants, will indeed be eternal, but so will his living, the aliveness his body only waited, but which, untethered now, freely soars high above and deep below even his own best metaphors. Since I could not be there yesterday at the first memorial, I am satisfied that Carolyn, Forrest's wonderful wife, and Galen, the senior minister at All Souls in New York, who served with Forrest for about 20 years, found those words helpful and had them read. But after I had written those words and shared them, I felt something people often feel after the death of a loved one. I felt guilty. I recriminated against myself. I should have called him last week when I thought of it. Instead, I just rushed off to do my laundry and wash the huge pile of dishes that had been building up in the sink. Or, I wish I had written him a poem before he died. After all, I knew it was going to happen. Even last year, no one thought he was going to live a whole year beyond what the doctor had solemnly foretold. But such feelings always follow a death, not just in me, but in so many people I have talked with over the years. And such feelings of guilt can follow the birth of a child, too, or a marriage, or any transition. I didn't do enough to get ready. I feel bad that I'm not prepared. I'm sorry that I'm going to make a mess of it. And so with feelings of guilt, I fulfill Ron Cook's request, and I arrive at the place I need to be this morning. Self-forgiveness, one of the compelling themes of Yom Kippur. Oh, I often talk about forgiving others on this day, or the whole concept of habits or promises, which are other great themes of the day. But every year, at the end of the service, as we shall today, we sing to Les Clean's haunting composition, "We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love." We forgive ourselves. The author of these simple words, my friend Rob Eller Isaacs, placed self-forgiveness first, forgiveness of others second. And I don't think that he wrote it that way to make it sing better. Joan Borisenko, author of the second reading, affirms what Rob wrote. Forgiveness, she insists, starts with ourselves and extends to others. She gives us a very powerful image to take home with us. "You can be clear," she said, "about whether or not a person's behavior is acceptable without judging that person. You're stupid is a very different statement from your behavior is not acceptable to me. If a person knows you respect him or her, your comments about behavior are welcome. If you are attacking a person's character, their essence, if you will, however, no comment, no matter how perceptive, will be heeded." Let's add that little dialogue to her first affirmation about forgiveness beginning with ourselves. "I have to admit, I sometimes dump on myself mercilessly and judge myself as stupid or even worthless when I make a mistake or excuse myself from something I've done, some hurt I've done. If I ever heard a parent in a public place like a store shouting at his or her child, 'You're stupid, you're worthless,' I would be angry. I would be appalled. I would be tempted to interfere. And yet, when I dump on myself and call myself names, I don't get angry. I don't interfere. And then this gets me into all sorts of trouble later." One study of this topic that I read this week was an examination of procrastination. You know, putting things off, making excuses for not going ahead right now. And to the researcher's great surprise, the habit of procrastination could be clearly traced back to a reluctance to forgive oneself of all sorts of things, relatively little things. We're not talking about murder or mayhem here, but putting off phone calls, putting off paying bills, procrastinating health treatments like delaying new glasses, necessary hearing aids, dentistry, things like that, and not for financial reasons either. Now, that really rang a bell with me. In my busy life, I can find all sorts of reasons to procrastinate almost anything, especially healthcare in these last couple of years. And I have not been very good at forgiving myself about that, which leads to more procrastination and more. Oh, I can be hard on myself for not doing enough, for not completing things, for not returning calls, not following through. I suspect some of you could tell me that same story back and claim it was your own. And maybe you, like me, have come to fear self-forgiveness as a kind of shuffling off of responsibility, thus making the singing of those words, "We forgive ourselves," every year, a tad uncomfortable. But this morning, I want to underline what Tom Rutledge reminded us all about in the first reading. The self-forgiving person, he says, is not, as many believe or at least fear, a selfish person. It is the person who remains stuck in self-doubt and self-condemnation who will lead the more selfish, less productive life. Self-forgiveness keeps us from being stuck. It keeps us moving. Yes, moving toward our goals, toward our wholeness, toward our ideals, toward each other, toward the deep, non-superficial lives liberal religion outlines for us. Rutledge offers us the homely but clear example of changing oil in a truck. If you don't maintain your vehicle, he says, you can't go anywhere or do anything, because without maintenance, it's simply going to just stop working at all. And folks who think of self-forgiveness as some form of escapism have probably fallen for the worst possible definition of forgiveness that I can think of, namely excusing someone by saying, oh, that's okay, it's all right, I'm not really that hurt. Well, you are too hurt. And when we hurt each other or hurt our own selves, it does affect us. To forgive, we have to at least admit that, start with where we are, hurt and hurting others, and then go from there. And even though I'm sorry may be the most difficult word there is, as our children's story asserted this morning, I'd like to suggest it's important to speak that word, not just to others, but to ourselves. I think we need to apologize to ourselves for treating our own spirits and bodies so unforgivingly at times. Which brings me back to Forrest. Forrest used to always define religion, and I've quoted this many times in one form or another, as our human response to the dual realities that we are born to live at all and that we will someday die. As Forrest grew older and then looked his own cancer in the face, he once told me that his own religious sense of wonder about everything had only increased, and that his sense that he knew very little about this mystery that we all share had not diminished at all. That's been my experience too. I know less each and every passing day. But I do know that this life is what we have right now, and that whatever its larger meanings may prove to be, at the very least, we need to keep ourselves well-tuned and honest by the act of self-forgiveness over and over again. We never need to stop that. And I can only end this morning's talk by praying that each of us, no matter our circumstances, can find some sense of real joy, the kind of joy that Forrest exhibited all of his days, even up to his deathbed, in our own lives.